was in the bullet, Lord judge me. My own sweet time didn't teach what I found. Only recognize simple things anymore. I don't wanna be defeated. I don't wanna be defeated. I don't wanna be defeated. I don't wanna be defeated.
Hi. You made it. Thanks for coming. Nice to see you. And all that stuff. Hello and welcome to another episode of Lead Singer Syndrome, a podcast where I, your host, speak to other lead singers about what it's like to be the front man or front woman of a band. Oh man, I am just in the best mood today. Had an absolutely incredible weekend hanging out at Sinnerfest 2.0, Norfolk, Virginia. That's right. Members of the Lead Singer Syndrome All Access Club, my sinners, we got together for an extravaganza down in Virginia. We were rolling like 50 strong. We had such, it was just, it couldn't have went any better. Steve from Punchline showed up. We did a live episode. It was amazing. Shout out to Steve, the best dude. That episode is going to be out next week. Don't miss it. Make sure you're subscribed. But seriously, all the support that's been given to me for this podcast over whatever it's been now since we launched the All Access Club, over 2 years now, has been absolutely incredible. And to see people show up literally from all over the world just to hang out together, to hang out with me. I played some tunes. We had some stand-up comedy, some great food, some even better conversation. It was just so perfect. So yes, maybe you want to come to the next Sinnerfest wherever we have it. I'm thinking maybe the next one somewhere on the West Coast. Check it out though. LeadSingerSyndrome.com/all-access. It's as little as $6 a month and you get, of course, access to events like this, but a whole bunch of bonus episodes, bonus content. And of course, really, it is what keeps this show going. Yeah, it's an independent podcast, so I need all the help I can get. Thank you very much for an absolutely incredible weekend. Now, this episode, this week, right now, it's a good one. It's a great one. Johnny Frank, formerly of Attack Attack, currently of his pseudo solo project, Bill Murray, is here. This is great. And you talk about a guy who got his start very young. He's only 28 years old, but he's been doing this a long time. And wow, it is just so crazy to hear some of these stories and some of this insight that this guy has. And he's got his head on straight, though, let me tell you. And what a good dude. And thank you, Johnny, for taking the time to do this. In other news with me, there is a new / old Silverstein album out. We recorded some old songs. It's called Redux. We went back. We literally re-recorded it. It isn't a remaster or a remix. We went in, we replayed the drums, we did the guitars, I sang all the vocals, I screamed all the vocals. We recorded in a really nice studio. It sounds amazing, and really, these songs just needed an update. And I'm pleased to announce the record actually charted on a bunch of charts. I think it was like in the top 100 albums or something, which is pretty cool for a record we put out completely ourselves. No help from a label. It wasn't even sold in any stores anywhere. So very, very cool. I want to thank everyone who checked out the record during the first week, whether you bought a vinyl, whether you just listened to it on Spotify, it's all good. But if you haven't checked it out yet, please do anywhere that you listen to music. It's called Redux. Also, tonight, Toronto Maple Leafs, Boston Bruins, Game 7. Oh, I'm nervous about this one. Very, very nervous. If you don't hear from me for the next few weeks, I'm in my bed sob crying. Yeah, I don't feel great about this, but come on, Maple Leafs. Come on, Maple Leafs. We need to get out of the first round. Interesting tidbit about the Toronto Maple Leafs. I know we got a few hockey fans out there, but the last time the Maple Leafs won a Stanley Cup, which is the championship in hockey, was 1967, which is a long time ago, you know? It's a long time. But what people fail to realize is back in 1967, there were only 6 teams. It's been a rocky road. It's been a rocky road, but Tonight's the night. Come on, Leafs. Go, Leafs. Go. We need it. All right. Let's get into this week's episode and my conversation with Johnny Frank. What's up, man? I'm here with Johnny Frank. Dude, how are you?
Doing good, man. Just chilling in the studio, hanging out, getting ready for this album to drop.
Yes, Bill Murray. Do you say it like that? Do you say Bill Murray or do you say Bill Murray?
Bill Murray, just like the guy.
Just like the guy. that must add to some confusion when you're explaining this to people.
I think mainly what it does is it just kind of hits, like, people think it's some weird pronunciation, and then when I say it, they're like, oh. it's just phonetic.
I'll admit, when I first saw it written down, I didn't make the connection until I was like, oh, wait a second, and then, yeah. And that, now I get it. It's interesting, and I guess we'll just jump in right there. You know, the music you've, you know, been making with this project over the last, you know, few years, and there's a lot of output. It's not like humorous, you know, there's no like, it's serious music, yet you seem to have a real, you know, humor about, I mean, just in the name, you know, I mean, Bill Murray, I just picture the guy in my head and I laugh, you know, and then of course, like the way, you know, you talk and some of the things you do, there's a lot of humor involved in the music, but just not in the music, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I wanted, the idea behind the band name was it made me laugh. And it's like, I like band names that have an immediate payoff. Like when someone tells right. you it, oh, what's the name of your band? Bill Murray. Funny. You know, it's already a positive experience and they haven't listened to the music yet. So that's kind of my thing. I mean, mainly above it all, it just makes me chuckle. But the, yeah, that's kind of who I am as a person. Like right. I'm pretty funny on the outside, but then, you know, there's a lot of darkness going on
yeah,
under
I mean,
the surface. So.
Well, right. I mean, and that's, I think that that's what, you know, I think that's always been something that people have done. They put out something super serious and then they'll give it like a funny title or they'll, you know, when they promote it or tweet about it, they'll write it in a way that's sort of like either self-deprecating or just completely unserious, and it's almost like that takes the edge off putting yourself out there, right? That's got to be the psychological reason, right?
Yeah, I call it the comedy blanket. Like
exactly,
it just,
yeah.
It just kind of, it takes like the punch away from it.
Yeah.
I feel like it takes the burden off of the person receiving the information just enough to kind of jump in.
Totally, man. Totally. So, yeah, I mean, so much to talk about, dude. But let's start with this new project. This new record is coming out on Friday. I'm sorry I lost count. How many records has your Bill Murray project put out now?
This will be 8.
Like, that's a lot, man. You know, where do you find the time? I mean, not just the time to put it all together, because all the records sound really good and they have a lot, you know, a lot of layers. It's not just like you're shitting it out with an acoustic guitar. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? There's a lot of obviously work that goes into this, but the creativity too. I mean, where do you pull that from? Are you just constantly thinking about it, constantly recording, constantly working on it?
Yeah, I'm kind of one of those people who's incredibly obsessive. And so, you know, I'll get into an album and that's pretty much all I think about for, you know, 5-6 months on end. Interestingly enough, with this record, I had written an entire record before that was gonna be this record, but I just realized it's not really what I wanted to do, so I scrapped it and wrote another one a couple months ago. But I really, one thing like that I realized is I had a buddy who was writing song every day, and for some reason there was just this thing in my mind, this block that I had put myself on myself that was like, I can't write, you know, more than one song a week or one song every couple weeks. And then I saw him writing a song every day and just thought, I can do that. I can write a song every day. And so I just realized like, I was putting a limit on myself, and so I started doing it and realizing, yeah, I can write like a fun riff and go from there. Once the structure is down, once the riff is down, then I think the rest of the song kind of falls in place, which is nice.
Wow. Okay.
And then
I have so many questions, but continue. Okay. Yes.
I think like a lot of the way I view music now, especially songwriting, is it's like a muscle you have to keep fresh and keep worked out. Like, so, you know, I'm afraid to be away from it for too long because I know that that muscle is going to atrophy and I'll have to bring it back up to speed, so to speak. So I'm always writing. That's my favorite part.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Man, that's wow. Wow. You're right about the songwriting thing. I think absolutely. Especially like, you know, you aren't touring as much as a lot of, you know, people that are, you know, doing the thing like you did with Attack Attack, which is you put a record out every 2 years and then you go nuts for touring for pretty much 2 years and then you do it again, you know, and a lot of people don't write in the in between. So you're absolutely right. Like you get back, like I get back to my computer after like literally a couple years of making demos and I'm like, I have to update all my software and I'm like, oh, my like FireWire doesn't like fit in my computer anymore. You know what I mean? Like things like that. And it's crazy how you're right about the songwriting can just kind of deplete, you know, you can just lose that skill that you pretty much is your livelihood, you know, and your most important thing you have in terms of musical skill.
Right. Yeah. You got to kind of drop a couple stinkers after a while and then you like get back up to speed.
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. Wow. Well, I got to ask a couple questions. First of all, when you say writing a song every day, do you mean like you write an entire song like from start to finish, or do you just mean like you kind of come up with like the verse, the chorus, then maybe an idea for the bridge? Or are you talking about like a polished song?
So as far as instrumentals, it's like pretty much a polished song. I do the vocals later. So I like basically stock up on a bunch of instrumentals. Like, you know, usually I like to keep my albums like 20 minutes. So that's, it's like a commute, you know, if someone's driving to work, they can just listen to the whole album.
Yeah. Yeah.
And by the time they get to work, they're pretty much done with it or, you know, done with it.
I should take your advice for this podcast, but we're way longer than that.
I know. Podcasts are different, though. I like long podcasts. But yeah, so I try to keep it short. And usually the way this record came together was I actually realized I wanted to write another one just because the previous one wasn't hitting me right.
Yeah.
And I just wrote one song every day for a week, and that's the seven songs.
Wow. So when you say, go ahead.
Yeah. So they're pretty much, the instrumentals are polished and are pretty much done by the time I start singing on them.
Wow. Interesting. And when you say scrapping a record, and I've heard about this happening, I forget what, there was a big band recently. Was it Panic at the Disco or something? Some band like that said, oh, we like recorded this whole album and we just like scrapped it and started over. And you hear bands doing that from time to time. And I always wonder, you know, and this is a question for you, but also just a question. I'm just thinking about this in the universe. When bands actually do that, and do you think they actually do that? Or is it like we kept like three or four of the songs and then we kind of like got rid of the rest, or you know what I mean? And then of course the question is like, if you have a record that's actually like more or less finished, you know, or demoed like well, even where does that go? Right?
Like, I don't know.
What did you do? What did you do with the stuff you scrapped?
It's just sitting on my computer.
So you conceivably put it in another album next Friday if you wanted to.
Yes, very true. But I mean, so I would say with the previous record, I had about 10 instrumentals and about four of the songs recorded vocally. So, I mean, it was on its way, but I just kind of stopped it on the last, like, 15% of the process. But, yeah, I don't know about other bands, man. Like,
right,
I feel like it's a mixed bag, you know. Sometimes it's hard to know when to stop, too. I mean, like, I went real far into that record before I was just like, this ain't it, you know. It's just got to – I got to kill it and move on.
You didn't keep,
who knows?
You didn't keep any of it. There wasn't like a song or two that, or even a part, a chorus that you were like, okay, I got to work this into it because this is actually good. There must be have been something there of, you know, that you liked, but I guess maybe not.
Well, okay, so I wrote a bunch of the songs maybe like 5 months ago, and then I wrote another one, and I was like, it doesn't fit on this record, and it was the last one I had written for the canned record. It yeah. wasn't even for the canned record, really, though. But I wrote it and was like, this is way better vibe than the other stuff. So I just kind of ran with that. So that kind of like tipped me over to writing the new record.
So when you're writing, are you sitting down? Like, I don't know how to picture it. Are you sitting on your couch with an acoustic guitar? Are you in the studio, like doing it all kind of in the box with like plugins and software instruments? Or how do you kind of typically approach, you know, let's say you have something in your head and you want to get it out?
Yeah, I'm very like, I love the DIY nature of newer music now that like anyone can do it. And you pretty much have no excuse at this point to write a great song and put it out. So with this record, I have an iMac at my, I have a studio, you know, that's like just a studio, but then I have an iMac back at my house and I just wrote and record all the stuff there. I actually went to re-record some of the guitar parts and was like, nah, just like the original, demo version's better. So I just stuck with that.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny when it happens. It's like sometimes you kind of nail this you know, tone or whatever you're going for, and then you try to go recreate it for like the real one. But these days, it's like, what is the real one anymore? You know, like, right. You're just gonna plug in like a guitar into kind of the same sort of preamp. You know, like run it through whatever. What's the difference? It's not like you're in a, you know, $1 million studio. Recording like a live amp anymore. Like, no one's really doing that.
No, yeah. And you don't need to. I mean, it's cool if you want to do that. But like, yeah, I think I'll record something and I'll be in a certain type of mood. And just the way I recorded it, I'm like, yeah, that gets that mood across. And I'm not really getting that across the time I'm trying to go back and redo it.
Yeah.
So I'm very much so like, don't overthink it. You know, if you did it a certain way and it doesn't sound like crap, then it's probably fine. And you're probably going to go back to it anyways. So I did record, I recorded all of it over at my house and then brought it back. And there was a couple parts that were out of tune I had to redo. So, you know, but for the most part, it's all the original demos and stuff like that.
Awesome, man. Cool. Well, thanks for doing this. A lot to talk about. You've had quite the career. You're not even very old, are you?
If I'm 28, I can ask. So
you're
28.
Old,
yeah.
No, it's not very old for all you've done. You know, especially you know, and I wouldn't mind going back and kind of starting at the beginning. Obviously, music has been, you know, a huge part of your life, if not your whole life, really. How did that start? I know you're from Ohio. What was it like, you know, for you growing up, and how did you, you know, kind of find music with maybe through your family or I know maybe through your church? I'm just kind of wondering how it all started.
Yeah, my dad has been in bluegrass and Irish bands my entire life, so I've been going to see them play.
What does your dad play?
He plays everything: 5-string banjo, guitar, fiddle, accordion, bouzouki, like cittern, drums. Like he's got like the whole thing. And then like my grandpa was in like a big band and my grandma was in like the symphony orchestra. So there's a lot of music in my past and stuff like that, but I pretty much grew up around it. And then, when I was in seventh grade, I really wanted to skateboard and my dad bought me a guitar and I was kind of like bummed about it, but then I just started playing it and loved it. And, you know, I've just kind of caught the bug and kept going. And then obviously, like, you want to play. So I joined up with the TAC people and we did the deal, you know?
Yeah, you did. You sure did. Well, that's a very abridged version of the story, I'm sure. You know, and I know you like long podcasts. So, I mean, you speak as freely as you want to. But yeah, man, I just, all I can think of when I think of Attack Attack is just how young you guys were. And I know I know Caleb was maybe a bit younger than you guys were, maybe a couple years younger, you know, so he's like on tour and he's like 15 or something. But still, I mean, you got all these young guys getting on a bus, actually, you know, pretty early on, like some success to where you're on a, like a full on bus on tour, being going across the country, places you've never been before. I just think that about that to myself and I'm just like, wow, that must have been crazy.
Yeah, I think what's interesting is like in retrospect, you realize how unique that situation was and how you're like, I can't believe that happened. But yeah, I mean, Caleb was 14 when we got signed and I was 18. I'd signed the record on my 18th birthday. So it's like, you know, I was telling my wife, I feel like I've lived two lives, which is nice. Like I got to kind of do this whole wild thing with Attack Attack and it was awesome. And like, there's good and bad obviously with everything, but, and then, you know, got to kind of restart at age 20 and rebuild something new. But yeah, like I remember, starting that whole thing up and experiencing like the growth, and it's just interesting to look back on it and think about the stuff that you just were accepting as like, yeah, this just happens. And you're like, you look back on it, you're like, no, it doesn't just happen. Like,
it doesn't happen.
That was very special. It was a very special thing that happened.
No, I mean, think of all the millions of people in America, millions of kids, you know, playing music. And for some reason, you know, your guy's band is the one that stuck. And I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of people that have come out of that. Like Caleb, for one, you know, Austin, you know, people have gone on to do, you know, special things in music. So, you know, when you guys got together as Attack Attack, was it clear that there was something special there, or was it just like what was going on through your heads?
I think the lack of self-awareness in all of us, you know, like especially when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever done this, but you look back at something you did without thinking twice as a teenager and you're like, "Oh my God. I would never do that now." Like
right.
Or I didn't even know that that was crazy. So yeah, like I think about how much really a ton of talent we had in that band, you know, even just seeing what Caleb and Austin have done out, you know, after the fact, and like just how they've released really fantastic music afterwards, and you're like, damn, that all came from just one little band, which is nuts.
You all learned together. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, and when I think back about it, we did practice every day. You know, we would hang out every single day. Like Caleb lived less than a mile from the school that a lot of us went to. So me and him after school would go to just walk to his house, and then everyone else would meet us up there. And we would just, if we were bored, we would just play music. That was just what we did.
Right.
So I was thinking about that and was like, that probably made us so tight as a band, and we didn't even realize we were doing it. We were just having fun.
Totally.
Like messing around on the drums and stuff like that. And his parents didn't really care if we were loud as hell all the time. So that was very nice as well.
I think you need that. Yeah, that's right. That's like when I was growing up in my bands too, like I have an older sister and she's like 7 years older than me. So when she went off to university, I like actually moved drums into her bedroom and we would jam in the bedroom, like on the upper floor of the house, and the whole, I don't know how the neighbors didn't care. Like it was, you could hear it down the block, you know, and it was the same thing. We practiced every single day, like just playing like, you know, shitty Nirvana and Metallica covers and stuff. Like, I don't know. It is really weird to look back when you're on the stuff you did when you were a kid. And you know, I mean, when you were a kid, did you think music was going to be what you were going to do?
I think that was the only thing I really cared, like really wanted to do. You know, yeah. I was into skateboarding for like a while, but I really just caught the music bug. And I do have that kind of one track mind personality where it's, if I like want to do something, or I just become obsessed with it, and that's all I think about and all I want to do. So when music came into my life and I experienced so many great things like fun shows and good friends and stuff like that, I just, for me, it was like, I don't want to do anything else. Like, I just don't care really that much about anything else. Sure. Like, I'm willing to do, and I don't even, I think for me too, it was like, I never really cared about getting big. I just wanted to have fun making music and writing it. Cause I just, I have like an incredibly hyperactive mind. And so when I'm writing music, it's just so stimulating that I just don't really think about anything else and just kind of puts you in that moment. I love that.
Absolutely. Well, you did get big, very big, over the two records that you did with Attack Attack and all the tours you did and everything. And one thing about Attack Attack was, it wasn't all, you know, love, especially from critics. It wasn't a critically acclaimed band. You had a very core group of fans that loved you guys, obviously, but there was a lot of negativity, let's just say.
You could say that, yeah.
And I know that for, you know, Caleb and I are good friends. I know for him, that was really hard. He was younger. He had, you know, a lot of issues, you know, just with, you know, image, and he didn't have the thickest of skin. How did that work for you? You were a little bit older, but still, I mean, reading some of the scathing comments online and all these things that people are saying about you guys, that must not have been easy for someone who's only 18, 19 years old.
Yeah, wait, okay, what was that website that was like, it wasn't as bad as Lamb Goat, but it was still kind of bad, but it posted like music news. It was like pure...
Oh, Punk News?
Punk News. I think that was one of them.
Or Absolute Punk?
Absolute Punk is the one. Okay, that's the one. So when we got signed, I remember this very specifically. It was posted on there, and I was reading through the comments, and I was like blown away with how, I mean, this is like when the internet first really started being used often. So, you know, before that it was, you had shitty dial up and you didn't really care and whatever. But this was like when the internet, you know, we started using MySpace.
Right.
Daily,
like social media just sort of started getting big. Absolutely.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So like, I remember, I was really excited. Holy crap, this website I've been going to for so long to get music news. Like, we're on here. That's amazing. Right. And then I started looking through the comments, and it was like, you know, F this band, hope these guys die in a car, you know, van flip, all that stuff.
Right.
The old school, old school trolls shit. So we, I remember reading that and thinking to myself, like, you gotta have a tough skin to, if you, I don't know, for some reason people hate us. I didn't really understand why. I still don't really. But I just was like, all right, this is what I'm going to have to deal with. I got to kind of flex the gut muscles a little bit so that I can take the punches. And, you know, with Caleb too, I think it's a different ball game. Like him, especially, I remember specifically when we moved him up to vocal. And he had told me, like, you know, I'm kind of freaked out about this. And I'm not a full on vocalist, but I think at the time when we made that decision, I was like, I know Caleb, if he decides to get good at something, he will be the best at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I knew that there would be a period where he would struggle, but I knew that like once he got the being a front man and the vocalist stuff down, like he would fly. And like, thankfully that really happened with him, which was awesome. But yeah, I it's a different thing when you're just like screwing around playing guitar and not having to really like be up front a lot, which was me more in the Attack Attack days. Like now that I'm playing with Bill Murray, like, and I'm up in the front, I'm like, oh yeah, I understand why like singers are a little more nervous, like, than when I could just like headbang in the background and not really have to worry about anything. So I think with all the hate, it's just a different level of hate that the lead singer gets than like the guitarist.
Well, this is lead singer syndrome, so yes. Yes, this that's right. excuse me. So you left the band, And I couldn't find like an actual, you know, statement of what you said, but the news postings kind of said it was to focus on your relationship with God. Where are you at with that now?
I'm an edgy atheist. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I don't know. I mean that in sort of a multi-level way. Like,
sure.
Where are you at with that now? As in, what was that decision like for you? You know, I guess, sure. Where are you at now with your faith is a question too.
Yeah, I'll answer both of those. So like, you know, you make such a big decision at that point and it has, I don't know. I knew that that's what I wanted to do because as the band pressed on and we got bigger and stuff, I just was not very happy with life. And so I think back then I would just attribute everything to some sort of spiritual motive, but there's just a lot of things where I just, my preference in life is I like writing music. I like routine. I like being home. I don't like all the craziness of touring a lot. And so I just think that after 2 years of doing that, I got a good picture of what the lifestyle was. And I was like, I don't really, this isn't for me, you know, like it mm-hmm. is for a lot. Other people love it, but I'm just like, I'm very much so an introvert and like kind of being by myself and stuff like that. And so I realized like, you know, maybe just on a personal level, this isn't what I want to do. So, you know, I left and yeah. joined up with a church and stuff like that. And, you know, that's another story for another day. But I think like as time goes on, the more I realized it, the more I just was like, yeah, you know, I have a certain personality and my personality wasn't really set up for that lifestyle.
Totally. But, you know, to be fair, I don't know if it was a, you know, you say good picture. I don't know if it was a good picture of what that touring life really was like. Right.
Sure.
Cause you get a bunch of teenagers in a van.
Like, exactly.
I mean, that's or in a bus. And it's like, here's all the like booze and girls and like no parents, right. Is the biggest thing. Yeah. No one's used to that. It's a lot different than most bands. They're in their early 20s or even mid 20s sometimes when they start, you know, actually getting to a level of success where they have, you know, a tour manager and a, you know, someone handling their guitars and drum tech and a sound guy. They have all these like different layers where like you can sleep in till 4 p.m., you know, if you want to kind of thing, right? Like, you know, you're a rock star, you know, and I don't think people can handle that when they're teenagers. And that's probably, no. was probably more the problem than anything. Like, you just burned out too fast.
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. Teenagers don't have the greatest conflict resolution skills. And so, you know,
right.
it was very passive aggressive and, you know, like it's as like a, you know, when you become a man and grow up, you're just like, hey dude, I didn't like when you did that. If we could find a way to not have that happen, you know, be direct with someone instead of like holding it in and then exploding on them over some like small detail later on.
Right. Or you just know as an adult, like grown ass man, just like you don't do certain things. You know what yeah. I mean? Like whatever it could be. It could, you know, we're talking about this runs the gamut. It can be anything from like, hey, they're trying to sleep, like keep it down, to like, you know, whatever, like real serious, you know, sorts of yeah. shit. So absolutely. I mean, that's just comes with the age and, you know, I mean, in a way, Attack was probably destined to fail, you know, just based on that.
I agree with you. There's something to be said about slow and steady growth, especially with a band. You see it all the time. Like as I've been making music for and helping bands make music for like almost 10 years now.
Yeah.
I see these bands just fucking skyrocket and they have no idea how to handle anything like that. And then they ultimately fail because there's just no foundation that they've built beforehand yeah. to handle the amount of weight and pressure that comes with that job. But I do agree, like as you get older, I feel like those things kind of even out and you like we touring with Bill Murray, you know, everyone's like 25 and up and it's a radically different experience, you know, like
no, yeah.
Yeah, we're just it is a very different experience, and you just have mature human beings that you're around instead of like completely unfettered, free teenagers who can do whatever they want because they have crew.
Yeah.
You know, they have that was like, you know, something that's I don't think that level of freedom is good for someone that young.
Like, no, I don't think so either.
Hey, you can do whatever you want, you know? It's like, sick. I'm gonna wake up at 5 PM and then I'm gonna play this show, and then I'm gonna get hammered. I'm gonna puke because I don't know how to deal with alcohol.
Yeah.
And then you know, go to bed. Like, whatever. Like, it's just, yeah.
So, yeah. I'm sure a lot of people have seen the Netflix The Dirt Motley Crue movie and they're picturing that. Yeah. You know, that scene with Tommy Lee. I don't know if you've seen the movie. It's worth a watch. I mean, it really can be like that, though. You know, if you want it to be, and, you know, who's going to tell you no? I mean, maybe someone else in your band will eventually, but at the same time, you know, that's not the way it works. You know, you know, you're on the same level and you do what you do and, you know, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's weird how you're so connected to these other people. And so like, if someone makes a really stupid mistake or decision, it directly affects you.
Right.
Because you're with them all day, every day. And so, yeah, it's just a very interesting way to live life as a teenager and to try and figure out. So yeah, I agree. I think with how fast we grew up, we were destined to fail. But honestly, I like that you know, we just kind of like punched people for like 2 years and then dipped. Like, and it was just this kind of like relic of this short window of time when we released music and that was the end of it, you know? Like, we didn't, I don't know. I like that. I think that's cool.
It's like Minor Threat.
Yeah. You get in and you get out, you know? And
exactly.
Yeah.
That's great, man. So I want to get to some of the stuff you're doing now. Obviously, you're very successful producing all kinds of material for other acts and your own. Everything you do sounds absolutely incredible. Did you just learn the ropes from, you know, just kind of trial and error? Did you take any actual courses? How does someone get so good at recording, especially when you know were on tour and stuff for all those years?
Okay, so I will preface that with like my first 4 years of producing, first 3 years of producing, I was solidly unhappy with what I was putting out.
Okay,
you know, it took. I mean, like, I wouldn't say it was horrible, but it took me a long time to get to a point where I released something. I was like, this sounds the way that I want it to, you know, like this sounds really good. So it took me a very long time, a lot of trial and error to get something solid down. I would say as far as school, I didn't do any school, YouTube University for the most part.
Right.
But,
right.
One thing that I will say is when Attack was in the studio with Joey Sturgis, I really just took a lot of the basics that he did and mimicked them. And then throughout the years, like I'd say once a year, I hit up Joey and I'm like, just talk to him for a little while. And he'll always drop some like small tidbit of information that like changes my world. So, he's been like probably my biggest influence as far as studio wise, that I have, and maybe like, what you would call like a mentor. So he's right. Helped me a ton. And even like just recording those albums with Attack with Joey, it's like, this is how he does guitars. This is how he does drums. This is how he does vocals. Seeing that, laying that foundation. And also at the same time, you know, I was blown away when I first went. I was like, you don't use real amps. You don't use live drums. And like, how does it sound so good? You know, and he really changed the game for rock music as far as I'm concerned. Where he was like, look, I'm going to make this huge rock record and I'm going to do it in a garage. And for me, it's like, I love that shit. I'm like, yeah.
Oh, dude. Absolutely. I mean,
it's so rock and roll.
Totally. And you know, that was what Rise Records was doing, you know, in those days. They were making records. They had a couple producers, you know, I think of Joey Sturgis and I think of Chris Crummett, were both like grassroots guys, you know, basically just making, you know, records in their garage, kind of records, and making them cheap, but just knowing what to do. And it really was a game changer. I forget who it was. I think it was Joey, actually, yeah, that made this record for, was it Before Their Eyes? And somebody played me a song of it. I don't know when this came out.
City in the Snow Globe, bro?
I don't know. I can't remember the title of it. All I remember about it was that somebody played it for me and was like, Everything on this is like fake. Like nothing is real. Like the drums are fake, guitars are fake, the bass is fake. The only thing is the vocals. And there was like a slide guitar or something. And I was how do you fake a slide guitar? You know? Like that when I heard that song, I was like, okay, literally anything is possible now. Like, I need to have a way more open mind. Because up to that point, I was like, no, we're going to go borrow every Soldano and Bogner, you know, amp we can get. And we're going to, you know, stack them all up and take a cool picture in the studio. Like, fuck Kemper. Now I'm like, I just want to, just give me a Kemper. I don't want to lug these amps around, you know?
And that's what you guys use.
Yeah, our last couple of records were all Kemper. We didn't use any real amps.
Dude, it's the future, man. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I do think there was like a weird growing pains period for like amp sims and stuff where it did sound very digital.
Oh, some of those like early Axe effects were pretty bad.
Oh, yeah. And even like for me, the thing that was interesting is like the Attack guitar tones sound very digital, but they sound good to me. Like, you know, the ones that Joey's used. So I'm like, yeah, it sounds digital, but to me, I kind of like that sound because all the Prada records and stuff, or like the Prada records and the other stuff that I was listening to, basically all Joey Sturgis's stuff.
Yeah.
Because I just could, every record he did, I was like, yes, this is what I want to do.
He had a sound for sure.
Yeah. And it was like, it sounds digital, but I like it. And but even now, like, I'll listen. I have a couple amps, sims that I use that I cannot distinguish the difference between that and like a recorded amp. It's crazy.
No, you can't. And that's actually funny that how that happened for me, because I was the headstrong guy. I said, I think it was when we were making our record that came out in 2015. Yeah. When we were putting out that record, so we were recording it, you know, in 2014. And I, you know, and everyone's like, okay, we got a Kemper and we're going to, and I'm like, no. Absolutely not. Like, we're gonna borrow that old Marshall JMP that we've used on all these records that we know sound great. And so we had, you know, that was one of the amps we had. And our producer said, okay, Shane, I'm gonna play you the JMP that we have here, and then I'm gonna play you the Kemper version of the same amp. Okay, I'm not gonna tell you which is which. So, you know, they recorded the same thing twice and blindfolded me, you know. And they played one and then the other, and I said, oh yeah, that's definitely, like, I can tell that's definitely the real one. Like, it sounds way better. And I was wrong.
Oh.
I was literally wrong, because, and you know, whoever had, you know, modeled that amp probably, you know, had a better cab or had better mic placement or, you know, took more time to get the tone or whatever, and it sounded better. And when that happened, I was like, okay, I'm all in on Kemper. Like, for real, I'm all in.
Dude, yeah, I mean, it's amazing, like, what those things can do. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I think that's my favorite part about being alive when we are in the music history right now is, like,
right.
You can buy a Kemper and have any amp sound you possibly could imagine that would have cost, you know, $5,000-$6,000, and you have it. I just think it's amazing. And, you know, for me, like, one of the things I love doing and one of the most important things I learned as a producer when I was young is I used to be like, the reason my shit sucks is because I don't have the right gear. You know, the reason this isn't good is because I don't have this amp or this interface or whatever. And then I was watching this interview of Drake's producer, Noah 40, and he he was like, we recorded this, you know, it was like one of my favorite songs, old school Drake songs. And they were like, we recorded this in the bathroom of a hotel. And I used a MacBook Pro, like a 2010 MacBook Pro. And we released that song that night. And I was like, that's so cool. And that changed my mind. I was like, I've realized like I need to stop blaming the gear that I don't have and just start making stuff that's good with what I do have. And so that's what I started doing with my studio. It's like, I'm going to use cheap gear. I'm going to like not spend a ton of money on gear just to prove that I can do it with
cheap
gear.
That's right. Yeah. Well, and, I saw your tweet that said, never trust a producer that shows you his gear and doesn't show you his mixes.
Yeah.
Exactly, I saw you tweet that. And I that kind of stuck to me when I was reading through your Twitter, you know, feed. I was like, huh, I like that. It's very true because, you know, I forget what band it was. Someone played me something and like the vocal sounded like just really like awesome. And I was like, oh, what mic is that? Someone's like, oh, SM58. Like an SM58 on the vocals in like a studio. Like that's a live mic. You know, everyone knows the SM58. That's like the gray mic. Literally everyone uses live, but that's not a studio mic, but I guess it can be.
Yeah. I mean, especially, you know, for me, I'm a big believer in like, if the song is truly good, it'll outshine like a bad mix. Or, you know, whatever, like a mediocre mix. Obviously if both are dope, then that's the prime. But I don't know. There's a lot of songs that I like that, you know, aren't necessarily the greatest mix, but then you like kind of get attached to it in a way, or a lot of different ways. Like people do things that are not maybe the right way to do it. I just love stuff like that. I love the rebellious aspect of it. Like for this new record, I recorded all the guitars with a Miller Lite Strat that my friends bought me for my birthday.
Miller Lite?
Yeah, dude. It's like a Miller Lite promo Strat from Indonesia. And what's so funny to me is I tested it against my American Strat and I liked the Miller Lite Strat better. And I was like, well, crap. I mean, so that's what I use live. It's like it just says Miller Genuine Draft on it. And
that's ridiculous.
I got it for free. So yeah, I've been like, I've been slowly trying to like get my gear as cheap as possible. So if anyone steals our gear on tour, I'll be like, whatever.
You know, what's a great example of that too, is I'm sure you've been to Nashville a few times and you know, when you're in Nashville and you just walk down whatever that main street's called, you know, where there's like a band playing in every single bar. You know, like you take five steps and there's another band playing like in the window and you'll just like walk in and you know, grab a Miller Lite in each bar. And these guys playing or girls playing, they all rip. And sometimes you'll be like, is that guy playing a Squire through like a PV combo? And it sounds amazing. And it's like, that's just the, you know, the proof right there that like you don't need amazing stuff to have amazing sound. It's all you. It's your skill. And you know, and that's like, I love seeing those guys in Nashville play.
Same, dude. I love like I think John Mayer could play any guitar and make it sound good, even if like the intonation was messed up, whatever. Like if you're a good enough player, you can pretty much overcome anything like that. Like you could give John Mayer a $50 guitar and he's gonna make it sound, you know, pretty dang good.
Totally.
Maybe not as good as a $5,000 guitar, but like for what it needs to be, like I think that you can totally overcome not the greatest gear.
And to be honest, I think I could see John Mayer totally getting behind the Miller Lite Stratocaster. I could see him playing that. I can picture that in my head.
I have like an unhealthy love for that guitar. Like I just, I, I can't get enough of it. It sounds so good to me.
Well, never. You got to take care of that thing, because if you lose that one or it gets stolen, you're never getting another one. That's a one of a kind right there. Right? You're going to have to hunt down the promo person for Miller Lite to be like, hey, so I got an odd question.
You know those
how many of those
guitars
did you make? I need another one.
So I'm looking on Reverb right now.
Get a backup. Miller, yeah. You break a string on stage. You're like, hang on a second. Guitar Tech brings you another Miller Lite guitar.
I couldn't find anything on Reverb. I'll have to keep looking. But yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, they say the same thing about Jimi Hendrix, you know? I mean, Jimi Hendrix was playing, like, he literally just turned the strings around on his guitar. So the guitar was completely not intonated, right? Like, you know, you can't intonate a guitar that's played the wrong way, from what I understand. But it didn't matter because Hendrix was so good, you know, at just he could play in tune. Like, you know, they said he was the only one that could play a tremolo bar like in tune.
I truly think, like, if you just have the mindset of like, I'm fucking doing this no matter what, you'll just, any dumb thing that could potentially get in your way, like, oh, this guitar's intonation's out of tune or whatever, or it's messed up, it's like, well, then when I go to the 12th fret, I'll just bend it a little bit, or like I'll tune it a little lower. Like, right. Just find a way around it, like, and find a way to work around it until you can get something better. But yeah, like, those things, you know, shouldn't stop you if you really want to go for it. And a lot of those great guitarists didn't come from like rich families, you know. They just came from nothing and had to use what they had. And I think, honestly, for me, I like the idea of limiting myself as far as gear, because it forces me to come up with creative ways to like figure out how to do stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I love that. I love that approach. And I'm sure I'm going to play a clip of, you know, I'll play a song at the end of the podcast, and people will hear your skills. I think the song I'm going to play is the one that has the bitchin' saxophone solo in it. Can we talk about that? Is that real?
Yeah,
is that real saxophone? I hope so.
Yeah, yeah. So I was finishing up the song, and there's this kind of like heavier part, and it just, dude, it was this like, I don't know if it was a voice in my head, but it was just this feeling like this needs to be a sax solo. And so one of my buddy's brother, I had heard that he played sax. I'd never heard him play. And I was like, dude, you want to have him record something on this? And like 10 minutes of recording, and we came up with that, and was like, yep, that's it. Let's go.
Wow.
Just had like a 57 on him, and
yeah,
we went with it. And he was like a shredder. So
I
feel like I got lucky with that point. But within like the first 5 seconds, I was like, oh, he's amazing. So we're good. And then once the solo was like, I put it in, and it was just perfect. And yeah. It definitely was like, this is what the song needed, and it just sounds so cool and unique to me.
Absolutely. So the record is out on Friday. Well, the record will probably be out when people hear this. But are you planning on doing some touring, some shows? I know you're a bit of a homebody, but what's the plan there?
So yeah, the guys that I have play with me, so obviously I'm doing all the writing and stuff and recording, but I have like buddies that play with me, and they all have full-time jobs and girlfriends and stuff like that. So we don't go out a ton, but I think the schedule we're doing right now is like 4 days every other month. And so we'll cover like a lot of ground doing that for the next, you know, however long. We want to do like, basically I'm probably going to be playing this stuff till I can't anymore. So, you know, if we just keep that schedule up for like 50 years, we'll get everywhere.
But, absolutely. Do you find it's a lot of Attack fans that have grown up a little bit and have discovered your music coming out, or is it new fans, or does it run the gamut?
There's definitely the mature scene kid is a definite factor there.
Yeah.
You know, the job. The scene kid with the job.
The job, had to get the babysitter for the kids. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So there's some of that. And then there's some people that, like, they liked Attack and then randomly found out that I was in that after they had liked Bill Murray. They're like, holy crap, you're the same guy.
Right.
And then other people who never heard of Attack Attack and are, you know, younger or whatever. But it's kind of pretty random as far as people. But yeah, so we play, I think we're going out in like a couple weeks to like Chicago, Indianapolis, and Cleveland. So that'll be a good time.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, well, I hope people can listen to this, can catch you on tour. And I'm sure after people hear your tunes, they're going to be like, okay, I need this. And if they don't, if they're not familiar with your band, they can go back and listen to 8 albums worth of material. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not every day you hear about a new band that you might not know about and then go, oh, they have 8 albums. It's like,
yeah,
it's like just, it's like when you're 13 and you find out about Black Sabbath or something, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's just what I love to do. And, you know, it was like, yeah, let's just write as much music as possible. I think the way I view it is I want to do at least 2 releases every year. To maybe 1 album and 1 like cover thing, but recently I've just been doing 2 albums a year, because right when the next one's out, I'm kind of, or right when the album drops, like a week later, I'm like, let's get this next one go. I actually already have stuff written for the next album, so we're getting it, dude.
And do you just put the stuff out yourself?
Yeah, well, actually, do you know Jared Alonji?
Of course.
Yeah, he started this media company called Boccato, and he just kind of like helps promote the album and stuff. And so I've putting it out under that name for this one. But, you know, it's not really a record label. He's just kind of like helps you when you need help and all that stuff. But yeah, for the most part, I put out all the albums myself and distribute it through DistroKid and all that.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, with sheer volume comes a little bit of cash your way, right? I mean, you know, it pays the bills, keeps the lights on, maybe?
Dude, yeah, I mean, what's crazy is, like, seeing how the band's grown, even in the past, like, 6 months, it's been nuts. And so as more and more time goes, more and more of my income is just from Bill Murray, which is cool. Like,
yeah,
because I made the project just to have fun with it, and I just wanted it to be like, this is everything that I would want exactly the way I would want it. So yeah, I mean, as time goes on, the more and more I make from Bill Murray, the more time I'll put into it and invest into it.
It's a beautiful, well, maybe 3 records a year, a beautiful thing. I love it.
Yeah.
And you have a couple other projects.
I think 2016 I did 3.
Wow. Well, it's crazy. Yeah. Like, are you still writing a song? Are you still trying to write a song every day?
It'll usually ramp up like when I'll get like an inspiration for what I want the record to be, and then it's just like all comes right after that. But I usually try to take a little bit of a break right after I put the record out, like a couple weeks or something, and then I'll start going on to the next one. It's like that scene in Elf where they finish Christmas, celebrate for like 5 seconds, and then they're like, time to get ready for next Christmas. I'm like, that's kind of how I am.
I love that. And you have a couple other projects too I want to touch on before I let you go. The March Ahead and Chair, which are both pretty cool projects and very different. Are those still ongoing? Are you still working on those at all?
Yeah, I just played a Chair house show last week or on last Saturday. And then we're going to probably, both of the girls in that band are like graduating college right now, so they're busy as hell.
Right.
And so once they're out of like finished up, then we'll probably be able to pick it back up once they move to 9-to-5 life. And then the March Ahead, I think we're doing an album this year, which is actually the first album we've ever done, because it's just been like EPs and singles and stuff. But yeah, me and a couple buddies write for that, and we were just like, let's just do an album, man. Let's knock one out. So
awesome.
That should be coming out maybe this year or next year. But yeah, I just try to, I don't know, I'm like, if I can write as much music now, I'll be really grateful that I didn't leave anything on the table when I'm older, and I just get to enjoy it all and listen to it all when I can't anymore.
So to answer that question, you do listen to your own music?
Probably more than anything else, yeah.
I love that you just fully admit to that.
Yeah, I like it. And it's cool as like this time goes on, there's more records to listen to. So you kind of are in like a different mood and you throw on a different record. So yeah, I listen to that and like Billie Eilish pretty much and country Western music. Those are my three genres I've been rocking super hard now.
You got to get your dad to play some banjo on there.
Dude, I know. I always joke with my friends, like, when I turn 50, Bill Murray's just going to be straight up country. Like, just like we're all going to have like beer bellies and just hanging out playing like chill country jams.
You know, but bluegrass is so good. Like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, similarities to bluegrass and punk rock, like, you know, the same kind of fast beat. I was talking to Tom from Bigwig about that because he's in a old punk band and now he's playing bluegrass in Nashville. And like, there is a lot of similarities, you know, between like with the tempo.
Oh yeah, dude. Bluegrass is so awesome. I mean, I grew up on bluegrass because my dad plays banjo. So like he has bluegrass bands and stuff like that. And It is like super, they just want to go fast, dude.
Yeah, I love it. I love it, man. Well, dude, thank you so much for taking the time. Anything else to add before I let you go?
Just check out the record if you want. If not, that's okay too. You know, you do what you want. It's called Wet Milk. Comes out on Friday.
All right.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I love it. All right. Well, Johnny, thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
So there it is with Johnny. What a good dude. And I absolutely love that he plays a Miller Genuine Draft guitar. He sent me a picture, you know, for the promo and stuff, and it's him holding it. So whatever you're listening to this on, maybe that picture is sitting right there. If not, check out the Instagram for the photo. It is it's just so good, and I just love the reason that he uses that guitar. It's so amazing. I wish him all the best, and you make sure that you go check out that Bill Murray stuff. And I gotta say, man, so, you know, I pick the music for the show every single week, and I don't take it lightly. Sometimes I spend a ridiculous amount of time picking what I'm gonna play at the end of the episode, but also what I'm going to play, you know, for that little clip that happens between the intro and when the interview starts. And sometimes I spend like an hour. It's ridiculous how much time I spend, because I really want that to be perfect, and I want people to get a good introduction to what this career is all about. So I went back and I listened to a lot of Attack Attack this week. I don't understand the hate, man. They have some pretty damn good riffs, some pretty good songs, and Johnny's a hell of a singer, man. So is Caleb, of course. So I don't know. But anyway, if you missed Attack Attack, it might be worth checking out. But hey, let's finish this off with a track, Life is Good, and yes it is. Here it is by Bill Murray on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love, and I'll see you next week with a live episode. Make sure you're subscribed. I'm under wire, and I can't breathe. I see you right there, standing next to me. Your head, my heart, your head, and my soul. And now again, 'cause this love will never end.